Hey, y'all, welcome to a new episode. First new episode. I feel like I have a lot of identifying words that are supposed to go before episode. First new, yes, episode of Her with Amina Brown. And I am your host, Amina Brown. I want to thank all of you for tuning in to the relaunch of my podcast. I'm so excited to be a part of the Seneca Women Podcast Network and all of our partners there and at iHeartRadio. So hello to all of you. This is the first of many new episodes. Thank you for tuning in to the best of Her and even more best to come. Y'all can see that I'm just throwing all sorts of words around because I'm so excited to be in here talking to you. What can you expect from this podcast? You can expect every episode we'll have just a little catch-up time, a little time to talk about maybe what's been going on. This week could be for me personally because I just feel like I'm a person that a lot of very crazy things happen to me and they turn out to be very interesting stories to share with you. Could also be a time that we talk about maybe some current events or a cool video that I watched online, all sorts of things. I love to have a segment of this podcast that is really me borrowing a little bit from things that I would do on stage when performing. So I've got a lot of fun comedic bits and poetic readings that I can't wait to share with you all. And in this podcast, sometimes there will be a guest here. We will invite a guest into our Her living room. And when I bring those guests into the living room, we will talk about different things that they may be doing in their work, in their life that are helping them to access joy, that are helping them to continue to be inspired. And I hope as you hear their stories that that's inspiring to you too. One thing you can always expect from this podcast, you can expect that we will be centering the stories of women of color here. And when I say women of color, what do I mean? I mean, Black women, Indigenous women, Asian women and Latinx women, you can expect those stories to be centered here. You can expect that when I bring a guest here, it's someone whose work and life that I really find inspiring, and I hope you will too. And when we don't have a guest, I like to call this segment a time for me to pontificate. It's a time that I can share with you some things that I'm learning, things that I think are important for you to know, maybe put you on to some music, some books, some art, some people that you can also be inspired by. And you can always expect at the end of every episode, whether I do this or I invite a guest to do this, I will always pick a woman of color for this segment, Give Her a Crown. And Give Her a Crown is a time to think about a woman of color who is doing amazing and inspiring work and shout her out. I also hope that when you think of Give Her a Crown, that you think of women in your life who deserve a crown, deserve to be celebrated. And it could be something really huge in their life that deserves celebration. It could be that you are so proud of what to some people may seem like a small thing. For some of us, we deserve a crown for getting out of bed. For some of us, we deserve a crown for caring for our aging parents. Some of us deserve a crown for not cussing someone out that day, right? So we want to be able to give the people crowns who deserve them. So that's a little bit of what you can expect from Her with Amina Brown. And I am inviting you into this audio living room that we have. So I hope you're getting comfy. I hope you took your shoes off. I hope you have a pillow that you can hold on to. But if you're driving, don't do any of that. Hold on to the steering wheel and focus on that. Okay, good. Yo, okay, we are, as of the recording of this episode, in the middle of a global pandemic, and I am living here in the US. I live in Atlanta, Georgia. So we are in the thick of it here. And I've learned a few things about myself during this pandemic. It has been a very interesting time of ups and downs. My life before the pandemic was very, very busy. So there were a couple of weeks during our time of quarantine that I just enjoyed having some time off and just not doing anything and eating whatever I wanted. I will tell you a couple of things I've learned about myself during this time, and maybe you also are learning these things. Number one, I learned that a pandemic for me is not a great time to start a new eating plan. I had planned to do a lot of things before the pandemic. I was going to get on this like high protein, low carb situation. And as soon as the pandemic came in, I was immediately like, oops, craving bread and craving cupcakes. And that is what I'm going to do. Eating pasta, whatever. That's what I'm having. Another thing I've learned about myself since the pandemic is it's creating some really interesting social strata, right? I'm having a lot of conversation with my girlfriends about how do you decide who's in your social distancing bubble, right? And I feel like part of this is judgy, but I don't know. I'm trying to figure out if it's judgy or not. So you all can tell me if you think this is judging. But I feel like there are different things that I'm looking for when I'm trying to find out if someone can be in my social distance bubble, right? Because at first we were all, well, I can't say we were all, but some of us were being very strict about quarantining and social distancing, right? That basically meant that you weren't leaving your house unless you had to, right? To get food or whatever other necessary things you need to get. But otherwise you were staying at home. Even most of us that had jobs that could be done from home, that's what we did, right? And I want to also stop here and give a special shout out to the people whose jobs could not be done from home that were and are still helping our country run. So big shout out to all of our essential workers, all the people working in the medical profession, all the people working in our grocery stores, people doing deliveries, just everyone doing essential work. Thank you. Thank you. Those jobs cannot be done from home. And those of us who are staying from home would not be able to stay home as much as we do if it weren't for you. So thank you. Want to give that shout out there. Okay. So while you're trying to figure out who's in your social distance bubble, there's like all these questions like, okay, are your people wearing masks, right? And like when they say social distancing, what do they really mean? And it kind of feels a little to me like when I was dating and how there were just certain little like catchphrases or different little things that a guy might say that I would immediately be like, oh no, we can't date. Like if I was talking to a guy, I remember I was dating this one guy and I asked him, hey, do you have like a theme song or just a song that motivates you, that really gets you going? And he was like, no, I don't have a theme song. He was like, I don't even really listen to music that much. And immediately in my mind, I'm like, ooh, we can't date. Like, I don't know. I don't know what to do with the fact that you don't listen to music. Like, what are you doing with your entire life if you're not listening to music? I don't know. So I find myself in conversations with people like family members, friends, whoever, and we're talking and like, they might say something someplace they've been. And as soon as they say that, I'm like, wow, you can't be in my bubble. And I feel like such a judgy person for thinking that way. But these are the types of decisions we're having to make now, you know? Like if I talk to someone and they're like, yeah, I just went on this date last night. And you're like, oh, like on Zoom? You went on like a Zoom date or like a FaceTime date? And they're like, no, I went out like on a date with this person. We went out and we just hung out and you know, we held hands, like they start saying some of those facts and you're like, oh no, you can't be in my bubble. That's how I feel. I've turned into the person that is judging those people. Also, I did not realize how much I missed just walking through a store just because I wanted to see what was in there. Like I haven't done that for months until we went to Whole Foods and there is a TJ Maxx next to the Whole Foods closest to our house. And it had not been open because, you know, TJ Maxx, like many stores, had been closed. And when I went to Whole Foods and saw that TJ Maxx open, like I really could not even think of anything I have need of to buy in TJ Maxx. But just the feeling of walking through the store and being like, oh, look at those candles. Oh, look at those face masks. I wonder what that shampoo smells like. I did not know how much I missed dear old TJ Maxx until I had the opportunity to just walk through there wearing my little mask. And you know what they had that I really needed is a jade roller for my face. And you know what? It was $8. And there's just something about shopping in person and getting to walk through there and just come upon an item. Like, I don't know if there's a way we can kind of replicate that online, but that's not how online shopping is for me. It's like a lot of searching and scrolling and Googling. You're not having fun, like walking through there and just like sniffing candles. You can't do that stuff online. So Shout out to TJ Maxx and all the people that work there. I thank you for your service. And lastly, I'm a person who loves going to the grocery store in general. That's one of my like favorite mundane tasks. Like I do make a list and I get really like organized about it. I have a certain like way I like to go through the store and all. And I never thought that I would be so excited to go to the grocery store even more so than usual, because for so long, that's like my only outing. I go so long without leaving my house. And then when I do, I'm like, oh, we're getting up early. We are putting on masks. We are going to go see what's in the store. And it has been really interesting during this pandemic time, the things that are left on the shelves and the things that are totally gone. Like where we live, there's still like no Lysol. Every now and then we'll come upon like some bleach or come upon like some sort of like disinfectant cleaner. And it might be a brand we don't even know, but we're so excited to find it. It's like some sort of treasure hunt type situation that I have come to enjoy. So shout out to all of the things I've discovered about myself during the pandemic. What have you been discovering about yourself during the pandemic? I would love for you to share it with me online, on socials. I would love for you to tell me all about that. This week, I am in conversation with Austin Channing Brown. And what a wonderful and fantastic person to welcome into our Her living room. And I'm also excited to report that since we recorded this, Austin is now New York Times bestselling author, Austin Channing Brown, for her book, I'm Still Here, Black Dignity in a World Made for Whiteness. So listen in as Austin and I are talking like girlfriends would in a living room, because she is one of my girlfriends, but we are also talking about the importance of centering the narratives and experiences of Black women. We're talking about the importance of celebrating and affirming Black dignity. And we are talking about some of the things that Austin wrote in I'm Still Here. And if you have not read this book, I encourage you to get a hold of it. It is a fantastic and important read. Check out this conversation with me and Austin. Y'all, I am so just excited that Austin has joined me today, because I want y'all to know everything about this book, because I got a few pages into it and I was like, she not gonna do this to me. Like something about Austin's book, it's like you're having like a little bit of a Harry Potter feeling. And I didn't really read Harry Potter, to be honest, but other people that have read it had told me that you start reading it and then you look up and it's like 5 a.m. and you're like, wait, I was supposed to do other things with my life. And that was the feeling I had. I got like a few pages in at first and I was like, oh no, Austin's not doing this to me. I have a job. I have things that I need to do with my life, please. And another reason why I'm so happy to welcome Austin to the podcast is because we sort of knew of each other in an internet way. We are in some similar spaces, speaking and different things. And we finally met at an event. And I don't know what the sessions was doing, but we was not going. And we got in this corner.
We did. We found ourselves a corner.
And went in, like, not talking about the weather and not talking about no sports teams, like, went in, like, immediately was like, Black girl meeting call to order, like, went right
Let's
there.
Do this.
And that was just the beginning of these moments that I have loved in knowing you, Austin. Just she has opened her home to me when I was in some dire straits. And she was like, just come to my house, sis. I got this soup.
And like, Amina brought cookies.
I did, because it was your birthday. That's right.
So she always brings me goodies.
We've had quite a few moments together that have involves good food and great conversation. So we're letting you all in on a sliver, because it'd be some realness that we're obviously not gonna talk about on here. But we're gonna let y'all at least have a small percentage of what this is. I wanted to talk to Austin about the dignity of the Black body, because this is a theme that is inherent in your work, period. In your speaking, in your preaching, in your writing, it's always showing up, which I think is so beautiful. So I like to start asking each guest an origin story question. So I want to ask you, what was one of the earliest memories you can think of where inside yourself you were like, I love being a Black girl?
So I attended private white Christian schools growing up, where I was initially often the only Black girl. So there would be other Black boys in my classroom, but often the only Black girl. And I remember on a very regular basis, all the like teachers and students and like the cafeteria workers asking me about my hair, because it could keep a curl, because it was thick and it was long. And it just like really floored them. And this was when I was like a little girl. This isn't like high school with, you know, the weave and the swoops and the,
come on,
you know swoops. What I'm saying? The updo, the the glitter, the, you know, I wasn't doing all that yet. Just my hair doing what it does as a little Black girl with the barrette. You know what I mean?
Yes.
It was just, people loved it. I loved it. Now, I will confess, I didn't like getting my hair done.
Life be hard. Mm-mm.
There was a lot of wanting to be yelling and screaming, and there was a lot of screaming on the inside.
Please, because we're told that you're not going to be out here screaming I'm hurting you, but you are.
But you
hurting me.
This does not feel good. Mm-hmm. And this pillow was no longer doing it.
Please, you are bringing up some Black girl memories right now. I'm like, it was like a rare moment I was in a salon. There were definitely some like,
right? No.
Sister so-and-so mm-hmm. is about to cornrow her daughter hair.
Listen,
and so you gonna go to her house and she gonna cornrow your hair too. And I'm like, but I'm uncomfortable rolled. And I've been here for like
it's been hours.
8 hours.
We
and
have not watched
yeah.
Mm-mm. So yes, I just remember taking great pride in my hair because it just moved so differently.
I actually, when I was thinking about this question, my answer is about hair too. I think for me, I was probably maybe five or six. I had a friend and her mother knew how to cornrow really well. And so she could do the ones where you could get like a little design and stuff. And then it went down to your, you know, my shoulders, and she would put the beads on the end. Whoo, when I would swing that hair, I thought I was in a music video. I don't know who else was performing and what they were doing. It was not music. I was in a video that was pretending to be a music video with no music. And it was just me, like the clack of those beads. I just felt like I am stunting on everybody. Like,
you know, my father actually used to cornrow my hair.
Really? Come on, Dad. Your daddy about to get the dad award out here, because I'm like, I don't even, please don't take away my Black girl cards, y'all, but I don't even know how to cornrow. I'd be out here like, my fingers be like this. Like, I'd be like, you supposed to part
this.
I'm
on a YouTube video. I'm like, this is not working. Maybe I should try on a baby doll first.
Right, because my...
Let me try on your hair.
My situation was not coming together. But that it is interesting that we both felt that moment about our hair. And I still feel like now a lot of times that I have that like, oh, I love being a Black woman moment. It's like something that my hair is doing that I'm like, you stand out. You take up space.
You know, mm-hmm. swinging it around. Mm-hmm. And I love that we're so, not intentionally so, but I love that there's so many secrets around our hair.
Yeah.
So child, I can't get on a plane and not have somebody be like, how long did that take? And then I'd be like, well, listen, it's multiple ways of doing this. So.
Yes, this is me in the aisle at Target, like being on the natural hair aisle at Target. This is me becoming a consultant. And you can tell that like the Black woman next to you is trying to see if she can catch your eye. Like if you're in the mood for that conversation, if you have time, and I'll linger around, and then she'll finally say, so I'm looking for a moisturizer and I tried this, points to rejected product. I tried this and it did not do the right things for my hair. But then my girlfriend said, try this, but I'm afraid to spend the money because I don't want to have. And I'm like, well, sis, if you're looking for a moisturizer like this, you could try this one. If you want one that's made of some organic stuff, try this. If you want, like, we done had a whole 20-minute conversation just on the Target aisle.
For me, it almost always starts with money. Girl, you know these products expensive. The last time this happened, the little sales clerk was... the sales clerk was like, "Do y'all need any help?" And she was like, "Y'all got any sales going on?
Please."
And she was like, "Well, I don't see any, but that tea tree oil down there is on sale." And we both looked at each other and laughed so hard.
What I'm gonna do with that, sis? I'm gonna put like a few drops on my scalp, and then what? Day. What's next?
Wash day is gonna need a little more than some tea tree oil.
Because hair will be out here looking like the top of a cotton swab. if all you have is tea tree oil, it's gonna be some struggles. I'm like, my hair need room to breathe. And it needs its moisture out here in these streets. Like, I need to provide my hair with the things that my hair needs for this world, okay? You mentioned in your book a poem that I love by Paul Laurence Dunbar. You mentioned We Wear the Mask, and you talked about this quite a bit in your book, which I loved. And I want to read We Wear the Mask for anyone here that's never heard this poem, and you should know this name, Paul Laurence Dunbar, because he's amazing. This poem, We Wear the Mask, says, "We wear the mask that grins and lies. It hides our cheeks and shades our eyes. This debt we pay to human guile, with torn and bleeding hearts we smile and mouth with myriad subtleties. Why should the world be overwise in counting all our tears and sighs? Nay, let them only see us while we wear the mask. We smile, but, O great Christ, our cries to thee from tortured souls arise. We sing, but, O, the clay is vile beneath our feet and long the mile. But let the world dream otherwise. We wear the mask." Oh, it's beautiful and haunting, right?
I mean, the fact that this could live over centuries
is amazing. And that I'm still reading it like, "Let them only see us while we wear the mask." Paul Laurence Dunbar, speak a word. Some of what I hear in the theme of your book and just your writing, your work, is this idea that as a Black person, that you do not have to wear the mask, which to me lends itself to being unapologetically Black. And that there are so many times that many Black people, I joke with my friends all the time, like, you know, waking up Black every day, have not woken up a morning that I was not Black, woke up every morning Black.
Yep.
But sometimes have been Black and apologetic for it.
Yeah.
Talk to me about how we can deal with the layers of that mask. How do we, I don't want to say arrive unapologetically Black. I think that takes time to work through, but how do we start working towards that? What would you say?
Yeah, I think a big part of this book is my journey towards that, right? So when I first read that poem, I was wearing a mask, and that's why it was so jarring, because I was like, whoa,
yeah.
I'm doing this, like, currently right here in this room where I'm the only Black girl in my English class. Just really didn't know what to do with that, because I had never really thought about, I didn't have the terms like code switching, and, you know, like, I was just out here living life. And I thought, man, there's a lot of things that all the folks in this classroom, including the ones that I really like and the folks that I really admire, don't know about my life.
Yeah.
That other Black students in my gospel choir or at the lunch table or whatever do. And so it was really my first time I was like, oh, what am I, when I'm around white folks, what am I protecting? Which I think is a real thing, mm-hmm. right? The need mm-hmm. to protect versus what am I hiding? Mm. And it's been, it still is, it has been a journey to figure out in what spaces can I be unapologetically Black?
Mm.
You know, it's not always safe. And I've been in plenty of jobs, and particularly where it wasn't safe, girl.
Right. How do you discern when a place is safe to be unapologetically Black or not?
It's real rough, but I look for signs. So during an interview, like an interview for a job, girl, I take that thing to a whole new level. I am probably the most Black in an interview because I am like, I'm just like, for a double shot on it, just in case. Because I feel like if you can handle the double shot, you can probably handle how Black I actually am.
I love this. I love it. Like, I'm Black, like I came straight from Wakanda. to come straight to this interview. You know, yes.
Do you want all of this? And then I tone it down, like, once I actually arrived, you know, once I got the job. Like, I'm actually not, you know.
I love it.
I wish I was all that I had pretended to be, but, you know, I can't play spades to save my life. So I think I'm getting wiser about particularly places where I need to make a long-term commitment, like a job. I think for other spaces, because I'm in and out of like white evangelicalism a lot with speaking and preaching and that kind of thing, I have started to ask questions about how they heard about me, what they've read that they really appreciate, to kind of give me an idea of whether or not it's really me they want or if it's an idea of me that they want.
Speak a word. Is it really me they want, or is it the idea of me? Speak a word, Austin.
And then I've started doing other things too. Like, there was a conference I went to recently where there was like just a lot of conversation around race. You know, they be doing the most, child. And basically, like, a professor had made an assertion that race is not a gospel issue. Talking about racial justice is like, listen, child. Mm. And I was like, okay. And so, to the conference planners where this was going to take place, I said, you know what? I need all exits marked. I'm going to need to know that security is in the room. I want to know if somebody makes a ruckus while I'm preaching, which one of you white folks is going to get up and calm everybody down while I go have a seat. You know, I want a public apology if something jumps off. You know what I mean? Like, I just had some, you know, some security measures. And if they had written back and been like, oh, we don't think that's necessary, like, we're still be fine. You know what I'm saying? If they didn't take it seriously, that would have been a no. Mm. So sorry. I can be there via Skype. Would you like to have a Skype?
Because when I'm Skype, I'm safe. I can be someplace where I'm safe. So
the foolishness starts. You know what I'm saying? Yes. And for that conference, she was like, oh my gosh. She certainly was like, I don't think anything would happen. But her next sentence was, here's your person.
Thank you.
And when I arrived, she took me into the space where I was speaking so that I could see where the exits were. Like, she just took it very seriously. So I'd be looking for signs, you know, that the white folks around me, the white folks in charge, the white folks who brought me in are taking my safety seriously.
That's good.
And sometimes I don't even make it about race, girlfriend. Sometimes I will even just be like, you know what? I'm an introvert, so I'm not going to be at that reception. I'm going to be at the hotel calling my boo and seeing how my son is doing. You know what I'm saying? And if they write back anything other than, oh, of course, we completely understand. We're so grateful for your time. You know what I'm saying? If that ain't the response, then I know who I'm dealing with.
And then all of a sudden, you don't have time. Like, you might have had time before that, but now you don't have time. Speaking of the ways that you use your voice and platform, which is one of the things that I just love about you as just a person, but I also learn a lot from you. And I will tell y'all, Austin Channing Brown is one of my favorite Twitter follows for a couple of reasons. Number one, because she is not here for the foolishness. And I always... you know, appreciate that. I just have a strong appreciation for people that are not here for the foolishness. But also, Austin, you do something that as a poet, I do not do very well. I am a super slow thinker. So like a current event might happen. And then like 7 months later, I'm like, end of poem. That has made me think about these things that I would like to write in a poem. Whereas the current event will have happened at like 9 a.m. Before 2 p.m., Austin is on Twitter like, a word about the such and such that just happened. Here is a Twitter toolbox for the ways that you cannot be about the foolishness that happened this morning at the such and such. Here are some resources where you can think about reading that so that you will not be racist. Here are some things like Austin gave these people the thread. Like you are always killing the threads. Like every time I'll be on the thread, like, yes, yeah. Mm. Oh, that person tried to comment with the foolishness. Oh, Austin not here for that. Oh, the people that follow Austin are not here for that. Okay. Scroll, scroll, scroll. You know, I'm paying attention. So when you are using your voice in these ways to speak very plainly, very directly, very clearly against racism, against white supremacy, I want to start with, how did you know this is going to be a part of my messaging as a communicator? Because some people believe that those of us who are communicators, writers, speakers, artists, that really we create all these things, but underneath them, some people would say underneath them is really all the same message, you know, that some people, you know, finding your calling is like, that's what's underneath their message. So it really doesn't matter how many different retreats, workshops, whatever they do, they're right. still coming back to sort of that message. And this seems to be one of those for you, that we can not only use our voices, but take action against racism and white supremacy. Do you feel like when you look back at your upbringing, you were always like, this is the person that I was going to become using my voice for this? Or did another moment come in your life where you were like, this is what I need to, if I'm going to put pen to paper, I need to write about this. You know, if I'm going to be on Twitter, I need to tweet about this. Like, did you have a moment like that, this epiphany, or did it just slowly evolve in a way for you?
So being a communicator is something that I was just aware of as a child. I remember like being a kid and, you know, when teachers like very first start to ask questions about like, what do you think? Like, what do you think questions? What do you think about this book? What do you think of, right? And I can remember like raising my hand and my other classmates telling the teacher to call on me. You know what I mean? Yes. Like, just like really weird. Like, I don't think that's normal. You know, so just, and my dad has this video. My dad used to do the camera for Sunday services, to record Sunday services back in the VHS days.
Come on, VHS.
And so he would have to go early on Saturday mornings to set up the video camera and make sure everything was working properly, you know. And he has this video of me. I have no idea where it is, child. But he has a video of me somewhere where I opened the hymn book and started reading it as if I was standing. Now, we in the balcony, but I was reading it like as if I was standing in the pulpit reading the Bible. Like,
I love it. I love it. I'm here for it.
So being a communicator is just always been in me, and I've been very aware of it. I became a minister when I was 14, became ordained when I was 19, but it was in college when I really started to find my particular niche around justice and really developing that passion. And so by the time Twitter rolled around, I was not an early adopter of Twitter. And truth be told, the only reason I got on Twitter was because I had started my blog. And one of my girlfriends was like, Austin, I need to be able to share your blog via Twitter. I need you to be on Twitter so I can tag you and share this good blog. And I was like, I don't really get it. Like, isn't it just people talking about what they did all day? I don't need to know who ate a chicken sandwich today. Like, I just don't, how is this going to enrich my life? I don't understand. So I really didn't get it. I don't understand Twitter at all. But I joined because I was like, she said she needed me, you know. So I was like, okay, cool. I fell in love with the Twitters.
Oh, yes.
I like the challenge of it, particularly when it was still, you know, 140 characters.
Right.
R.I.P. And I loved how concise I could be in a way that is very difficult, honestly, for me to be in person. So when I go somewhere and speak, inevitably, child, somebody will walk up to me and be like, you know, that was not as hard as, you know, like they searching for the word. But what they really trying to say is, you a lot nicer than I thought you'd be.
I'm nice, but I'm not nice about white supremacy. Get that straight and bring me some sweet tea.
Get it right. You know, but I like that about writing in general. Yeah. And I think Twitter was where I figured that out. That I like that I can say the hard things because people are reading.
Right.
You know what I mean? I'm not standing in nobody's face like, you gonna get rid of that white supremacy today. You know what I'm saying?
Right. Like,
I ain't doing no exorcisms, you know, but when I write, you know, people have a chance to process. They have a chance to, there's an emotional removal, you know, because I'm not standing in front of you. And so it just feels like a space where I can be unadulterated in what I'm thinking and saying and just like let the reader deal with that.
handle that. And I am drawn to folks who appreciate that. I am drawn to folks who are like, yes, give me more of that. Or, ooh, I didn't know that term. I'm so glad I have that term now. Or, dang, you just put language to how I was feeling and I couldn't explain it. But, you know, now that I've read this, I'm like, that's exactly it, you know?
Yeah.
And so that's how I really fell in love with Twitter and decided to go a little harder in my writing than I do when I'm in person.
I want to give a special shout out to your girlfriend that, number one, told you to blog, and number two, told you to get on Twitter. So she's going to be a recipient of the She Did That Award because we are appreciative that she encouraged you to do this.
It's true. The only reason I started any of this is because of a girlfriend. So there was a girlfriend who told me I need to start a blog. There was a girlfriend who told me I had to be on Twitter. There was a girlfriend who took me to a meeting that she had with an editor and was like, yo, this girl come write you too. Like everything is because of a girlfriend.
I love that. I love that, Austin. And I love it because I have such a great community of girlfriends too.
Yeah.
I love that those moments when I might text you out of the blue and be like, girl, such and such, what you think, sin? And we can just, or those times that we see each other and you can just connect. But I love in particular when we can have a community of girlfriends that are sometimes seeing us far past what we can see in ourselves that would push to be like, sis, you need to do this and you need to do that. And why don't you do this? And why are you not charging this? And, you know,
right.
Like having girlfriends who are like that.
I'm not even going to tell y'all how Amina be beating me up over ticket prices and what I need to be charging for stuff. I'm not even going to tell you. I'm just going to let that slide. Because Amina be getting your girl. She be getting your girl. I just want you to know. But that's what girlfriends are for, yes. You know, to remind you of how much you're worth.
Ooh, speak. Yes. Price is also going up for Austin Channing Brown next year. Okay, continue. So, whatever. I'm just saying. I'm just letting y'all know. So, I want to ask about your book process. So, you get to the point where you are like, I'm going to write a book. But you obviously have this choice. You could write about anything you want. You could write in any form that you want, even with some of the content that you wrote about. It could have been more of a how-to. It could have been more of something that were going to be very research-based, but you chose the form of the memoir. And I just feel endeared to that because I love to read memoir. And it's also a similar form that I chose for my book because I was sort of sitting at the beginning of that book process like, what do I really have in my hand? And I have that I'm a storyteller. I have that most strongly. And I would rather lean towards that and see what stories will come out. What was that moment like for you where you had the choice of form and you had the choice of content? How did you decide you would do the memoir and you would do the memoir sort of through this lens of Black dignity?
I actually pitched this book like 5 years ago. At least 5 years, I've lost track now, but pre-Black Lives Matter, pre-Ta-Nehisi Coates, pre all the stuff that makes up our like daily life experience right now. And child, those publishers were like, so this whole book is about a white girl who touched your hair? Like, is that, was you like standing on a cliff when that happened? Like, did you almost get pushed off? You know, that's like, they were like, where's the life and death experience? You know what I'm saying?
Right.
You know, like, and I was, oh, okay. So child, by the time I circled back to running to write a book and having an agent and get my little proposal together, I must have written 4 or 5 proposals.
Wow.
Where I was trying on different voices. Like you just said, like, is this going to be the how-to? Is this going to be filled with research? And child, I was like, I would get started. And I would be like, but I am not a historian. Then I would scrap that and start a new one. I'd be like, ooh, but I'm not a theologian. So I would scrap that and be like, ooh, but I'm not an academic. I don't even know how to cite this. You know what I'm saying?
Come on, cite. Like, bring that word back. Yes.
Nothing. I got nothing. So I really, you know what I really did was I went back through my blog and took note of all the posts that I enjoyed writing and were popular.
Yeah, that's good. That's a good balance. Popular and the things you enjoyed writing. So
good. It's like flew out of me. And one of them was a post that's not super long that I did on Digeria Becton when she was the black girl who got tossed around by the police at the swimming pool.
Yeah.
And I started that out by pretending that I was in the room when she was getting her hair braided. So I talk about her sitting between her auntie's knees and hearing the click of her auntie's fingernails braiding her hair down, and how she got up and stretched, and how they took a break and did, you know, whatever, you know, danced around the room together, you know, and then said, and you know, she got dressed for this pool party that she was all excited about, that she got her hair braided for. And all of a sudden, she was on the ground in the grass with a police officer in her back. And girl, that post just came out. Like just my connection to her as another black girl just made that so easy to write. Emotional,
right?
But not hard to write, you know? And it was one of my most popular blog posts. And that was when the light bulb went on. Like, oh, when I marry like these small experiences that most black women can identify with, right, to these larger social issues, that's when I've struck gold. Mm-hmm. And so ultimately that's what I ended up trying to do. And then, you know, when Coates came out and I was like, oh, well, if we can write about being a black man from the hood, I think we should be able to write about being a black girl surrounded by white folks. That's what I think.
Speak a word.
That's what I think. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, it really did unfold, but it was a long process, child. I easily spent a year just writing proposals, trying to figure out who I am as a writer.
I think I spent a long time on proposals too, because part of the proposal process is this, like, what's my voice, or what am I anticipating my voice is going to be? Because I have to say, even what I sent in as my proposal was, in theory, what this book was going to be. But how the book actually came out, that was its own thing. When I sat down to actually write the book and was like, oh, you don't want to be that thing that I wrote in here. You want to be something else. So I need to let you be yourself while I learn to be myself. It was like an interesting,
that's real,
interesting relationship with your book, and with how, in particular, and you'll have to tell me if this is your experience too, in particular, when you are writing these personal stories of your own life experience, that there are some ways that writing healed me, like sealed up some places where I had been wounded. There were some places where it changed me, totally transformed me in some ways that I just couldn't even account for until the book had been out. And I was like, I'm somebody different than I was when I first sat down to figure out what this was going to be. I mean, I know you are, we're right here as your book is launching, but do you feel some of that sort of transformation in you as a writer, in your voice? Do you feel any of that as you're thinking back now on the writing process of your book?
I did, because I think my voice was very teachery before, you know, because I had been doing workshops. And even if you, like, I haven't deleted any of my blog posts. So if you go back to the very beginning, they're very teacher-esque. And like, here's step one, or here's a great metaphor for how to think about this. Or, you know, they're very like, come along on the journey. And girl, the closer we get to Black Lives Matter, the more that disappears. So like, get it together, white folks.
Get it together.
But then when writing the book, I think what was transformative for me was making declarative sentences. Because I had to think about whether or not I would still be standing by those declarative sentences a year from now, or 2 years from now, or 3 years from now. And so I want to give myself grace in that there may be things in this book that I, you know, decide to change 10 years from now and be like, you know what, that's what I thought then, but I have grown, I have evolved. But on the whole, you know, I had to really ask myself, do I find white people exhausting? Yes, I do. And, you know, that just had to be a sentence in the book. But it was like that declarative sentence, like, this is what I think today. Mm-hmm. Knowing what I know, right? Knowing what I know, this is what I think today. Yeah, that was transformative for me to think about what I believe, what I'm willing to declare.
I love the way you're describing this, that declarative moment, because I think that is also a moment of reminding ourselves of our dignity when we are able to make these statements with no equivocations, mm-hmm. with no apologies, mm-hmm. that this is what it is. This yep. is how it happened, how yep. it happens, like this, yep. period. And let exactly. the space be there.
Exactly. Exactly.
There's a lot of power to that. I want to ask along those lines, you have a whole chapter on creative anger mm-hmm. in this book, which I love so much because within the last month in my various conversations with Black women, some of it has been with just professionally other women who are author, speaker, you know, performer mm-hmm. world. And some of it has just been with girlfriends. And sure. there are so many moments that the phrase, well, I was going to do this or I was going to say this, but I didn't want to be that angry
yep.
Black woman.
Angry Black woman. Yep.
And I used to fight against it, you know, like hey, I am not that angry Black woman. I can, mm-hmm. you know, communicate these things and do these things without, you know, roaring about everything. Mm-hmm. I can do it. Mm-hmm. And now I'm like, sometimes I am that angry Black woman. And I have a right to be angry.
Hello.
It is not wrong or bad for me to mm-hmm. be angry and for me to express my mm-hmm. anger. So yes, sometimes I am an angry Black woman. Uh-huh. And sometimes I'm hurt and I'm disappointed. And that by itself makes me mad about Hello. Whatever the injustice is that has happened. Yep. But it's interesting to me that many of us as Black women are still trying to
undo that.
Yes, yeah. yes, to undo yeah. that thing that we learned. And I loved that in this chapter, which I want y'all to check out Austin's book, because you talked about how that anger can be useful. Yeah. I love just the idea of creative anger. Talk to me more about that.
So I was, in college, I was definitely that girl who was like, I don't think I even ever thought about myself as being angry. It wasn't even that I put anger away. It was just so communicated to me that you have to speak in a certain way in order for white folks to hear you, that I totally bypassed my own emotional needs, you know, and went right to, okay, well, getting this fixed is more important, right? So let me go ahead and talk about maybe how much I'm hurting, or, you know what I mean? Like, let me be sad, or like, let me try on any other emotion, basically, other than anger, since, you know, anger will be dismissed. And I'd be angry.
Sis.
I'd be angry.
And rightfully so.
And rightfully so. So that was something that, like, I had been thinking about, again, especially through, like, Black Lives Matter and all these videos and the number of times that I find myself angry on a very regular basis. And I was like, you know what? I think I'm kind of intimate with my anger. Like, we spend a lot of time together, you know? We be sitting on the couch and things.
Yes. So, yes. Anger, would you like some popcorn? Together. Come on, right. Anger. Get you a snack. Yes.
And so I picked up Sister Outsider, which was a book that I had been meaning to read forever. Finally got around to it and got to Uses of Anger, the essay called Uses of Anger. And I was like, oh, what? When I say revelation, and I'm almost ashamed to be like, it was a revelation. But it was. I'm going to just be honest. It was a revelation to me when Audre Lorde says, and forgive me for paraphrasing here, but when she says anger is evidence that an injustice has occurred, like anger is evidence that something's not right here. And it can be fuel when channeled correctly. It can be fuel for making things right.
Yeah.
And I was like, wait a second. Like, and I had to really pause and think about how many things Black folks, Black women create that started off with anger. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, I'm real upset that all these Black girl ballerinas out here wearing nude whatever ain't nude for them. You know what I'm saying? Somebody got a little upset. And so some Black girl said, you know what? We gonna fix that. And we gonna get some Black girl nude shades. That's what we gonna do.
Yes.
You know what I'm saying?
Yes.
Like, there's so many things. We just be like, I'm tired of being left out. I'm tired of being unseen. I'm tired, right? The whole Black Lives Matter organizing is essentially rooted in anger, right. and not just anger, love and dignity right. and a whole lot of other things.
Right.
But we I'm about to sit here and pretend like we wasn't also angry about mm-hmm. Trayvon's mm-hmm. death and about Zimmerman getting off. And you know what I'm saying? Like, we ain't gonna sit around here and pretend like anger doesn't also fuel action. And so, yeah, so I think about anger very, very differently. And even when I wrote that chapter, girl, I started to try to document, even in my own life, things that I did that initially were out of anger.
Hmm.
So which I wrote that were initially out of anger, mm-hmm. what groups I started on my college campus because I was angry about something that happened, you know, what meetings I attended because we were angry about an injustice or a crisis or, you know what I'm saying? And I was like, my life is filled with examples of the usefulness of anger.
Mm.
But I had to read Audre Lorde in order to like bring that into my conscience, you know?
Yeah. So powerful. I think it's so powerful to be able to take something that we learn to diminish, that we learn to compartmentalize it. And even like the image of you saying like, me and anger are friends. We hang out and we, you
yes,
know,
we
like,
do.
Sort of like we get to invite these parts of ourselves that we were told to shut out and shut down and not acknowledge and not love.
Because the first thing we're told, especially as Black women, is that we're being divisive, that we're not being unifying, that this is the opposite of love, right? Like, the world is quick to tell us why our anger is destructive
mm-hmm.
and only destructive.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was a real gift to my life for Audre to say to me, not so, not so. Like, it could be if you allow it to be.
Yeah.
It could be.
Yeah.
But it doesn't have to be. It is not. Your anger is not inherently bad.
That's so good. And so healing, you know, like hearing you repeat that right now. It's healing for me to hear, and I think it's going to be healing for so many people listening too. And one of the things I wanted to bring up that I loved in your book is you described justice work as holy.
Yeah.
And I love that because it's so true. Mm-hmm. It's so true. If we are in whatever, you know, arena, space, you know, whatever area we find ourselves in, if we are using our voice, using our resources, using our influence to help see justice, in particular mm-hmm. for people who have been marginalized and have been mm-hmm. oppressed.
Yes.
That is holy work. I think that's so important.
It's so transformative. I mean, it transforms you. It transforms the other. It transforms relationships. It transforms your worldview. It transforms your theology. Like, nothing stays the same. Like, it is such holy, intimate work because it forces you to ask some new questions mm. about yourself, about your people, about your God, about your community. You know, I think that's what, so I used to lead short-term mission trips on the west side of Chicago
mm-hmm.
and child, you know, I did my best to, you know, shed some light. and it was mostly teenagers, you know. And I had this one parent who we used to give out surveys at the end.
Mm-hmm.
And I was going through the surveys and all the surveys said like parent or child or whatever. And so the parent had written, this was really interesting, but I'm concerned that you have opened Pandora's box for my child.
Huh?
And I was like,
Did I open it? Or
interesting.
Or it been open? I'm trying to.
Right? And you know, girl, I couldn't even be offended. I was like, that seems like a really accurate metaphor. Like, it is Pandora's box. Like, your child is going to be asking all kinds of new questions. Your child is going to look at the news differently. Your child is going to listen to the pastor differently. Your child is going to be sitting at your dining room table asking some new questions. Like, you're right. I think I did just open Pandora's box.
And then you were like, good luck with that.
Have fun. See you next summer. But yeah, I continue to be intrigued by the ways that I am changed by the work that I do, by the people that I encounter, by this new language, by the ways of reading the word, the prayers that I pray. You know, like, I understand why people resist it. I understand why people resist it. And I understand why other folks try to contain it so that it's only gender justice or only justice for Black folks or only, you know what mm-hmm. I mean? Like, mm-hmm. I understand. Because justice for one eventually invites the question, justice for who else?
Right.
And it becomes transformative very, very quickly. So I do. I think it is really holy work.
The title of your book being I'm Still Here, which I love that. And something about being here is being present. It's being whole. It is fighting for justice and joy.
Yes.
What does your process look like to remain whole as you sometimes are, you're speaking such a direct truth to people.
Yeah.
And sometimes you may be in a space where you're saying that truth to someone who has not been willing to let that in. Mm-hmm. And that makes them act out because they don't even, they're like, well, I don't know how to process that. Or I'm thinking I might know how and I don't want to. So this is how I respond to that. I have this two-part question. One, how in the face of that, in the face of even when you're on Twitter, you're speaking about things that happen repeatedly.
Right.
You're watching what happens to the Black body in violence repeatedly.
Right.
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 How do you find wholeness and healing as mm-hmm. this is a part of your work as a practitioner?
Mm-hmm.
And then what would you say for Black people and maybe people of color in general that are in predominantly white space? That are facing racism every day, that are facing some head-on aggressions every day.
Yeah.
How can Black people and people of color remain whole and healed in the process too?
Yeah. So I think the first answer for me personally changes based on the season and based on what's happening. And I know that's like cheating, but it's I'm learning it's the truth. Like, I'm a human being. And so my son, it was just born about 7 months ago, and my ability to read headlines has declined sharply. Mm. Or all I can read is the headline. So I have a vague idea of what's happening, but I cannot open the story. I can't watch the video. Like, I can't do it. I'm so tender right now and spending so much time thinking about his life and his future and what I want for him. And it's too closely linked. You know what I mean? To like read that story and to try to resist the thought that I might have to insert my son's name in that story. Like, it's too close right now. And so I find myself staying aware of what's happening, but not diving into it right now. Knowing that there are other Black women and other Black folks who can,
right,
who do space and who do have, you know, and so part of it is realizing that I'm not the only voice out here speaking about race and justice. You know what I mean? There are other times when, like when Djeria Becton happened, I just cried, and that's just what my body needed. Like, my body just needed to cry and needed to be honest about my connection to the offense that she suffered. As she lay on that ground and cried for her mother in embarrassment and in shame and in pain. Like, I just so connected with that sound in her voice, right? The desperation in her voice for that to come to an end, for somebody to come rescue her, for somebody to come protect her. And so in that instance, all I could do was cry. Obviously, writing is, you know, often how I try and process and make sense and reassert dignity. After Charleston, I had to go back to my home church because I was so devastated by my fear of walking into a church that I was like, you know what? I'm not even just going to go to any church. Like, that day, I went to a church. But that following weekend, I went back to my home church with my father. And so it's spending a lot of time being self-aware. I think if I had to boil it down, being aware of what I need, being aware of how much of the pain I can contain, and then figuring out how to release that, whether that's through writing or through a conversation with a girlfriend or finding each other on Twitter or, you know what I mean? Like, I feel like we've figured out some new ways to take each other, you know? I can't even remember which verdict it was, but I remember Black Twitter was basically like, okay, so all day today, while we were wait for this verdict, we gonna drink water, we gonna have tissues ready, we go, do you know what I mean? But there was like a checklist.
Yeah.
We all knew we was gonna be sitting in front of the TV waiting for this verdict to come through. And so I just really appreciate the ways that we're learning how to process through this and not just pretending like we're immune from the work. And then for the second half of your question, so I have this small, teeny tiny little section in the book called How to Survive Racism at an Organization That Claims to Be Anti-Racist.
Speak a word today, Austin. Speak a word.
Because so often, first of all, we do be trying, like we do be trying to vet the organizations and figure out who's for real about this inclusion life, you know? And we still get disappointed because it's racism, even at these organizations that claim to want anti-racism and racial reconciliation and whatever they want to call it. And it's rough out here. And so a few things that come to mind. One is to not go into the organization believing that you have to change everything. Because there's something about even that language where, because we want to participate, right? We want to participate in change. We want to be a part of movements. We want to be a part of doing something good. And so when folks start using that language, we get really attracted to it and then find out that it's all on us. And that ain't right. That ain't right.
Nope.
It ain't right. Mm-mm. That ain't the way to change an organization. And so that would be one. Another one I would say to spend your like first year trying to find your allies. Yeah. Like, don't do nothing in the way of like until you figure out who your allies really are, who's coming at good funding, who, you know, who called you when the latest crisis happened, who brought you some food, who wrote a post on their own website, who goes hard on Facebook. You know what I'm saying? Like, who is out really living this life that you can connect with, so that you're not doing this work by yourself, right? And build up your little coalition so that you're not alone. And if you find that you are alone, I'm gonna need you to get out.
We don't want you to be in the sunken place.
Don't be in the sunken place, y'all, please. Now, that comes with a game plan, right? Most of us cannot just be out here quitting our jobs when somebody makes us upset. I understand that. That's not what I'm saying. But there is a such thing as an exit strategy. So I'm going to need for you to be out here looking for this new job. I'm going to need for you to be thinking about this entrepreneurship life. I'm going to need for you to be like, you know, every organization ain't like the one you in. So maybe we can hop over to somebody else who's, you know, starting networking, start figuring out where might you be safer? You know, where might you just be more safe? And be ready and willing to move, especially with our generation, child. We ain't about to retire from no place after being there for 30-some years. No. That's not the life we live in. And since that's the reality, right, now that comes with some hard things, too. But the beautiful thing about that is that you can move. That's not unusual. That's not weird. Ain't nobody going to look at your resume and be like, oh, you ain't worked no place for 20 years? You know, like, don't nobody expect all that. And so it gives some freedom, too, that if you can see that the organization has gone as far as it's willing to go, or you are being too harmed, then it might be time to make that move.
Ooh, that's some good advice. Come through. Come through. Well, Austin, please tell the people, first of all, how they can get a hold to this book, because the book is out now. I know y'all can't see me, but I'm doing my out now hands. I'm blinking my hands. It's out now. You can get this book wherever the books be at.
The book.
So
yeah,
where can people get these
like
things? Where can they learn more about you as well if they want to follow you and learn more from you as well as access this book? What are the things? Tell me the things.
So any place you like to get your books, please feel free to get this book. I personally would love if you asked your local independent bookstore to bring this book in or ordered it from them. That would be amazing. But if you got to get your Amazon on, you know what I'm saying? Do you, boo. And then I've got that good website, austinchanning.com. And then we already talked about how much I love the Twitters, which is @AustinChanning. I also do have Instagram, also at Austin Channing. And then my Facebook is my whole name, Austin Channing Brown.
This week's edition of Give Her a Crown, a segment in which I like to give a shout out to a woman of color that is inspiring me, doing amazing work in the world. So this week, I want to give a special shout out to Tamika Mallory. And I want to give her a crown because as we are watching such a needed and continued global uprising happen in America, as a part of the Black Lives Matter movement and as a part of seeing racial justice happen for Black people in America, Tamika Mallory is one of the voices and leaders at the front line of this movement. She is using her voice, using her body to community organize, to be an activist. I want to give a shout out to her organization, Until Freedom. If you are looking for an organization to give to that is doing frontline justice work to not only ensure that all Black lives matter, but especially to ensure that the names of the Black women and Black trans women whose lives have been lost as well are continued to be uplifted and that justice is served for them as well. So, Tamika Mallory, let's give her a crown. Her with Amina Brown is produced by Matt Owen for Soul Graffiti Productions. As a part of the Seneca Women Podcast Network in partnership with iHeartRadio. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review the podcast.